Welcome. This is Dr. Nalini Chilcove. Welcome to our live Grand Rounds call for the Foundations of Integrative Oncology course. This call will last approximately 1 hour. We'll start with a clinical pearl and then move into case studies or questions that have been submitted by you. Also, take little breaks so that if you want to ask a live question on what we're talking about, you'll be able to do that. Please be mindful of patient privacy and ensure that all of our discussions are confidential and anything that might identify a patient would be redacted in your question or on any records that had been submitted. For your reference, you are currently muted, but please feel free to press *7 to unmute your line if you have a question or a comment to add to the discussion. So let's get started. I wanted to tell you, number one, that I'm just looking at all the people who are on the call right now. We have people from California, Virginia, Ontario, Canada, Northern California, Idaho. So great. So if you, just to remind you, if you want to speak, press *7 and that will unmute you. So the first thing that I wanted to do on our last call, I had some questions about aromatase inhibitors and then decided to do a little mini review for you about aromatase inhibitors. So I'm going to jump into that. And then we have quite a few very interesting questions that were submitted by several different students. We'll go through those, and we should have time for Q&A on this call tonight. There was not a formal case study submitted, so we'll have plenty of time to talk. So let me go ahead. I want to talk about aromatase inhibitors. So first of all, for those of you who do not know what aromatase inhibitors are, this is a form of hormonal therapy that is used in postmenopausal hormone receptor positive breast cancer patients for the most part. Aromatase inhibitors are basically a class of drugs. They're used in the treatment of breast cancer and also in gynecomastia in men. So basically they block an enzyme called aromatase. And this is a preferred treatment for hormone receptor positive breast cancers. Typically, aromatase inhibitors are not offered to premenopausal women. Rather, tamoxifen is offered to premenopausal women, and we'll talk about that a little bit. They are usually prescribed for 5 years after a woman completes her therapy, which might be surgery, it might be chemotherapy or radiotherapy, and in some patients today, women are not receiving chemotherapy, but they're just receiving hormone therapy because we have tests to screen to see if chemotherapy would be indicated. So you will often have patients who are on some kind of hormone therapy if they're a breast cancer patient, since 70% of all breast cancers are estrogen receptor positive. So the mechanism of aromatase inhibitors is that they will inhibit the effects of aromatase, which is a tissue enzyme that it's a P450 enzyme that transforms androgens, aromatizes androgens into estrogens in the tissue. So what's really interesting is that the concentration of estrogens is actually can be as much as 20-fold higher in breast cancer tissues than in the circulating plasma. So you can't really measure the blood to see how high the tissue estrogens are. And so this also raises the question of whether or not cancer cells have a mechanism, if they are estrogen dependent, to actually more growth signaling. I've given you, you'll get the slides for this little talk, and you'll be able to see some of the chemical structures of cholesterol, which is the base molecule for all the steroid hormones, and then how aromatase changes androgens into estrogens. You'll be able to see that if you like to see the chemistry. Now, hormonal therapy includes a couple of different approaches, tamoxifen and aromatase inhibitors being the primary. And there's what's called neoadjuvant treatment as well as adjuvant treatment. Neoadjuvant means that before any other therapy is embarked upon, we use a treatment to shrink the tumor. That could be chemotherapy, could be hormonal therapy. So sometimes a woman with an estrogen positive breast cancer will have neoadjuvant hormonal therapy to shrink the tumor and then have surgery. Thereby, a smaller surgery will be needed. The less tissue traumatic surgery will be the result if you can shrink the tumor ahead of time. Now, there are adverse effects associated with hormone blockade, and we'll go into a couple of those in this talk. But aromatase inhibitors are used quite a lot, and they do inhibit recurrence of breast cancer, and it's very hard to argue against hormonal therapy in women with hormone receptor positive breast cancers. So I generally will talk to the patient about how long they're going to stay on it. The standard of care is 5 years. And some women have a lot of side effects and some women don't. And of course, the women who have more side effects want to go off the aromatase inhibitors. And so I encourage women who don't feel like they want to do any kind of prescription drug to go on the aromatase inhibitors for 2 years, see if they tolerate it, see if we can manage side effects, and then at the end of 2 years, have another conversation about it. And so that's how I approach it, so that we can have a window of time where if there are microscopic estrogen receptor positive cells left after treatment, that we can starve them out with an aromatase inhibitor. So generally, that is my conversation with patients. So when you have an activated receptor, if estrogen binds to an estrogen receptor, then that turns on a cascade of gene promotion in the nucleus of the cell. It can activate a cascade of other genes that cause a cancer cell to go into cell division and turning off apoptosis, so cells become immortalized, and also genes get turned on to trigger angiogenesis, the development of a blood supply. So the estrogen receptor, once turned on, sends signals to the nucleus, and a lot of the characteristics of tumor cells that allow them to flourish, proliferate, and metastasize are unleashed. So you get an inhibition of a lot of cancer cell physiology by blocking the estrogen receptor. One of my dear friends and colleagues who is part of this course and on this call, Dr. Cynthia Watson, suggested that women start slowly on aromatase inhibitors so that the body can get used to it, just in the way menopause normally unfolds slowly, that there can be less side effects if you give the body a little adaption time. And so I think that that point is well taken. It is absolutely not standard of care to do that, but it's much gives the body a chance to go into a changed estrogen environment at a more gentle way. Now, there are other therapies that premenopausal women are recommended. So the class of drugs that tamoxifen belongs to is called selective estrogen receptor modulators. And so those are drugs that bind to the estrogen receptor and change its behavior, change its ability to turn on this cascade of other genes. In premenopausal women, ovarian ablation is also a therapy, or ovarectomy can be an approach to take away estrogen stimulation. Of course, these are quite radical methods. Ovarian ablation can be done surgically or chemically with drugs like Lupron, or the generic name is Luprolide, and that stops estrogen and testosterone production in the ovary and the testicles via pituitary blockade. And then also there's a drug called fulvestrant, or Faslodex is the brand name, and that's what we call an estrogen receptor downregulator. It actually can bind to an estrogen receptor and change its conformation so it can't send signals into the cell. And it also can actually sort of cripple the estrogen receptor. So those are the common approaches to estrogen receptor positive cancers that we're trying to modulate with drugs. So the primary approach with postmenopausal women is in fact aromatase inhibitors. So there's the newer third generation drugs used in the United States today are Arimidex or anastrozole, Aromacin or exemestane, and Femara or letrozole. These are commonly prescribed drugs. And, you know, as people metabolize drugs differently, if a woman has a lot of side effects on one of the drugs, then we often just try a different drug to see if that drug's a little easier on her. Some women who have a lot of side effects take a break and then go back on it. So you will see these drugs used commonly. Sometimes I'll just have the patient take half the dose if their side effects are really intense. So, you know, we can try to smooth out the ride with some of our toolbox and also with trying to individualize the care a bit. Now, there are natural aromatase inhibitors. They're about 30 to 50% as effective as the prescription aromatase inhibitors. And it's not uncommon for women to stop taking their aromatase inhibitors because they don't like the side effects. And this does put them at some risk of recurrence. And so it's better than nothing to do the natural aromatase inhibitors. So those are the following botanicals and phytochemicals. Scutellaria barbata is one of my favorite herbs. It's related to Scutellaria bicolensis. It has a lot more studies on breast cancer, and I always include it in a formula when I make a compounded formula. And it's very high in chrysin and apigenin, which are polyphenols that have an aromatase inhibiting effect. Resveratrol is, in fact, an aromatase inhibitor. Genistein, the isoflavone from soy, is an aromatase inhibitor, which is so interesting because we think of soy as a phytoestrogen, but in fact, nature is very wise and balances things out by also including aromatase inhibition in a whole plant. And the chrysin you can get by itself in a capsule, and I often use this. It's quite strong. It is in the family of polyphenols and bioflavonoids, and it's not toxic at all. I usually give 500 to 1,000 milligrams a day of chrysin. Similarly, with the resveratrol, I'll give about 1 or 2 grams a day, and the Scutellaria barbata similarly, or it will be part of a more complex formula. And then there's another botanical that I like quite a lot, Urtica dioica, which is stinging nettle, and we use the root of that. And nettles have, the root has a fatty acid in it, and also lignans that have this aromatase inhibition property, and I quite often will put nettle root extract into a formula that I'm compounding for a woman or a man. We'll say that some prostate cancer patients are also on hormone blockade therapies, and in some men, prostate cancers are estrogen driven as well, and so then you think about these same therapies. Now, I was just at a conference in which one of my colleagues told me that he uses the mycelia of the medicinal mushroom agaricus, which comes from, it's the same as little white button mushrooms, the edible mushrooms. And I was not aware of its use as an aromatase inhibitor, so I looked for studies on it, and I only could find mouse studies and cell studies. He's a very seasoned naturopathic oncologist. His name is Dr. Michael Traub, T-R-A-U-B, practices in Hawaii, and he uses this in his practice, but I have no experience with it, and I couldn't find any human studies on it. The other thing to think about is obese patients, their fatty tissue, adipose tissue, is a factory for estrogen. And obese women do not respond very well to aromatase inhibitors because the aromatase inhibitors don't really work very well in adipose tissue. So we have to think about what else we can do in obese women. Of course, the primary thing is help them to lose body fat and build muscle. But just so you know, that we would not expect as good a therapeutic response to aromatase inhibitors in obese women because the aromatase inhibitors can't block the estrogen that's being made in their adipose tissue. So that is additional risk. So that's the beauty of our system, where we have a bigger toolbox and we can use other things as well. Now, the adverse effects that women experience who are on aromatase inhibitors are the symptoms that women experience during menopause, but in particular, they will have the most severe complaint is musculoskeletal pain, arthralgias and myalgias on the aromatase inhibitors. This is the main reason that women stop them. And there are estrogen receptors in fascia and connective tissue, in ligaments and in tendons. And so menopausal women are less flexible and have more difficulty with range of motion over time because their connective tissue is less elastic. And this happens in a more extreme way in women on aromatase inhibitors. Women will also experience increased bone turnover and decreased bone density. So we have to watch and make sure that their bone density is being screened and encourage them to do weight-bearing exercise and have adequate bone minerals on a daily basis. Women will also experience increased vaginal dryness and the loss of libido and painful intercourse on these medications as well. And there is some increase in ischemic heart disease and a kind of a loss of the flexibility and the vasodilation of the coronary arteries. So we do put women at higher risk of coronary artery disease when we block the aromatase. So I want to just talk about a few interventions that are useful in managing particularly the arthralgias and myalgias in these patients. Both electroacupuncture and regular acupuncture without electrical stimulation, there are good studies on that. And the plan is usually 10 treatments over about 8 weeks. So you give 2 treatments a week for the first 2 weeks and then 1 treatment a week for the balance. And that's usually the pattern. And I will often give treatment for 12 weeks in a row once a week. And then maybe have a woman come back once a month for a treatment if we're finding that acupuncture is a useful therapy for that woman. Also, acupuncture is very useful for some of the sleep disruption and hot flashes that come with a lowered estrogen impact. So there's very, very good studies. One of the studies was only done over 6 weeks, giving treatments twice a week. So I put those studies into your notes for this Clinical Pearl lecture. I use vitamin D quite a lot in these patients. Optimizing vitamin D in many patients will almost eradicate their arthralgias and myalgias. And you need to check the blood and make sure that you're optimizing vitamin D. A lot of the studies show that 25-OH vitamin D over 40 is sufficient, but my goal for my patients anyway is between 55 and 80, and a lot of more current studies indicate that 25-OH vitamin D around 75 is optimal. I was just at a lecture where the naturopathic oncologist was shooting for a 25-OH vitamin D of 100, but I don't feel comfortable with that. I'm a bit more conservative. I want to make sure that we don't change calcium metabolism, which can happen at those super high doses. So I'm shooting for about 75 these days, and that requires somewhere between 2,000 and 10,000 IUs of vitamin D3 a day, and monitoring the blood to see when you are achieving optimization, and then evaluate what the maintenance dose should be. So definitely vitamin D and acupuncture are my go-to in these women. And then on top of that, exercise and stretching are really important. Basically, women who are getting stiff and having a loss of elasticity in their joints and then having pain from that do much better if they're stretching a lot. And so there's a lot of studies on yoga and Tai Chi and improvement in the myalgias and arthralgias of these women. But basically, you need to move, and you need to move anyway, and you need to move through your full range of motion and keep those tendons and ligaments and fascia lengthened and stretched out. And for some women, that by itself is sufficient. Teach them a very simple stretching or yoga routine or a very simple full range of motion routine for their joints. And that in and of itself will work for quite a lot of women. So those are the main things that I do. I have put into this slide deck for you that'll be posted to the library some reference articles. I have one called The What, Why, and How of Aromatase Inhibitors, so that you can look more deeply at the physiology and mechanism of action of these, should you so choose. And then I have another article that I've posted called Natural Products as Aromatase Inhibitors, which is a nice discussion. I also often use maca in these patients and in menopausal patients in general. Maca is in the family of sulforaphanes, or rather the brassica cabbage family, and is rich in sulforaphanes, but it's also rich in plant sterols. And so it has a non-estrogenic sterol-like effect, which can help with some of these symptoms in many women. So that's my little clinical pearl for this month. I will stop, and if you have a question, you can unmute yourself by pressing *7, and I will answer your question. Okay, no questions. All right, so I'm going to move ahead with the questions that were presented. And needless to say, Judy submitted a couple of great questions as always. If we were going to give a prize to the person who asked the most questions, Judy would definitely get it. So here's Judy's first question. You mentioned different protocols, such as immunotherapy, to avoid cutting. Do you like to avoid even biopsy cuts? So let me clarify. I am absolutely not opposed to biopsies or to surgeries. In fact, I'm very pro-biopsies and surgeries, so I want to clear that up. The reason that I feel it's important to biopsy and important to do surgery if you have an operable tumor is biopsies, number one, give us the opportunity to analyze the tumor cells and know exactly what type of tumor cells we're treating. And that's crucial to picking the right therapy. So I have a patient who came to me many, many years ago, and she, on breast exam, mammography, had a lump in her breast. And she came into my office and said, "I want you to treat me. I have a lump in my breast." And I said, "Treat what?" Because I had no idea what kind of tumor that was. So it took me a bit to encourage her to go get a biopsy, but then we knew what kind of breast cancer she had, and then we could move forward. Now, this was a very stubborn patient who then did not want to have a lumpectomy, and she had this very, very small tumor in her breast. So she did not want to have an incision and a lumpectomy. So I arranged for her with a breast surgeon colleague of mine to have cryotherapy, to have the tumor frozen, which is done in Japan. It is not actually approved here. It's approved for fibroadenomas of the breast, non-cancerous lesions of the breast. So the surgeon contacted the company, the cryotherapy company, asked the company if they would authorize her to perform this procedure on a malignant lesion. They said that would be okay. And then the patient had to pay out of pocket because insurance would not cover an unapproved procedure. But that's what she chose. Now, there's some benefits and problems to that. One is that when the frozen tumor cells die, the debris from those dead cells sheds out into the circulation and awakens an immune response. And this also happens with radiotherapy. When the cells of the tumor die and shed off into the bloodstream, there's an immune response that helps the immune system then to recognize those tumor cells. And then we've actually sort of inoculated ourselves against some of the actual tumor in the body. So that's a plus. But the downside is when you don't do an incision type of a procedure, we could not stage her because we couldn't get a sentinel lymph node. And that is usually done when a breast surgery is done, even a small lymphectomy, so that we can get a sense of whether or not we have only local stage one disease, or if the cancer has traveled to the lymph node stage two. And then we have a much more serious problem because now the tumor cells are in the circulation. And so those are the pluses and minuses. And that was many, many years ago. And this patient never wanted to be scanned and never wanted to be staged. And she was very stubborn about she wouldn't have a medical oncologist. And I really think it's very important for anyone who's ever had cancer to be followed by a medical oncologist. There are a lot of psychological reasons patients don't want to be followed, but a lump was just found in this patient. And my feeling is perhaps if we'd had a medical oncologist, we might have had a scan to follow this patient because we didn't know the staging. So you have to think about these patients who really want to refuse conventional care. I really, the reason I call this integrative oncology is because I think we have to use all the tools and not just say only natural therapy. So this patient was on aggressive botanical nutraceutical protocol for many, many years. And then in the last several years, she's in her 70s, she started to develop pre-diabetes, and that elevation in insulin and glucose in her blood, I suspect, acted as growth factors and growth signaling and may have led to a recurrence in her where she was stable before. So we don't really know. That's my hypothesis. So similarly, if a tumor is operable, you want to get it out of your body. You absolutely do, because it's a burden to the immune system sitting there. And so the first thing we want to do at diagnosis is reduce tumor burden and figure out how to do that. Something's not operable, or we want to shrink a tumor beforehand, then we do a neoadjuvant therapy, which might be hormonal, it might be chemotherapy. So I am not opposed to biopsies or surgeries. It is true that when you put a biopsy needle in or a scalpel in, there's a trail that follows the needle out and or the scalpel out that can be, you know, cells can draw upon that. But I feel that it's a risk versus benefit kind of a dilemma, where the benefit of knowing what type of cells you have or the benefit of removing a tumor mass is far greater than the risk of spreading the cancer systemically. It is not uncommon if there's a recurrence, for example, in a breast surgery, for the recurrence to happen along the incision line, but that can often be cleaned up. So it's a risk versus benefit. I think it's a misunderstanding to think that all biopsies and all surgeries spread cancer. They certainly can, but we're hoping that the immune system and our good therapies will contain that locally. Of course, we can't know what's going on microscopically, unfortunately. So that's my answer to that question. I'll stop and take a pause if anyone wants to comment or ask a further question on that topic.
Hi, Nalini. It's Judy.
Hi, Judy.
Hey. So that question was specific about basal cell carcinoma on the face.
Oh.
And it was in reference to the patient that had had already 13 surgeries.
Oh.
And you had mentioned something about certain lights that can show basal cell. And
yeah, that question's further on. Maybe it got separated out because, yeah, there's another question we have in here from you. So, okay, I remember that case. So your question about lights, I'm not aware of light therapy for basal cell carcinoma, but I'm certainly not an expert in it. But certain kind of lights are used in the dermatology setting to better visualize what is there that we can't see with the naked eye. And I also don't know what those are, but, you know, a dermatologist would know that. I'm not aware of light treatments, but there now are immunotherapy treatments and topical treatments, you know, with 5-FU. There's a drug called Aldara that I think we mentioned last time that is a local immunotherapy treatment that produces an inflammatory local response, which often resolves these. So that's pretty much it. So there was another part of your question, which was about bone morphogenic proteins. Right?
Yeah, I had just come across that. Had you heard anything about that?
Well, here's my feeling about it. I have never used those supplements. So Judy asked the question about there are supplements on the market that contain bone morphogenic proteins that are marketed as a way to address risk of osteoporosis or even restore bone density as a treatment. And I have to tell you, I have never been comfortable using those because bone morphogenic proteins have been implicated in promoting certain cancers. So I just think we don't know enough. And so I think the question should be asked, you know, should we be giving any kind of morphogenic proteins? Could they act as a growth factor in other tissues? And so I just have never used them because I'm worried about that. And so that would be the answer to that question that you had asked. And also you'd asked about, what was it, Raman spectroscopy. And I had to look that up because I didn't know what it was. My understanding of that is that it's actually used in the laboratory setting to analyze molecules. I'm not aware that's used in the dermatology setting.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Anybody else? So let me go on. We have a new member of our community, Dr. Todd Binkley. And I understand he wasn't able to be on the call, but I know he'll be listening. So he had a couple of questions that I wanted to answer. He asked, do you have any recommendations for integrative oncologists in Southern California? And so number one, my first answer is, most of the people on this call and in this course are not in Southern California, so you can reach out to me separately and we can discuss your patient for an appropriate local referral. But I thought this is an opportunity to talk about what I think about when I want to refer to an oncologist. And certainly we want to make sure we have an oncologist who specializes in the type of cancer that this patient has. We want an oncologist who is leading edge and knows all the therapies that are possibly available, and an oncologist that's collaborative, or a surgeon who's collaborative, or a radiologist who is collaborative, because we want to have a team approach and a respectful relationship. So I look for that. And we have to remember when we're looking for integrative oncologists, there actually are not hardly any. A lot of the doctors that do integrative oncology therapies that are not medical oncology therapies are often naturopaths or functional medicine clinicians who include this in their practice. And so the reason for that primarily is oncology is highly regulated, and oncologists legally have to follow standard of care if they're part of an institution, and they don't get to decide what they are going to do with the patient. When a patient comes in with stage one or two, the oncologist must follow standard of care. That's all the insurance company will cover. If the patient fails that standard of care, then the oncologist gets more wiggle room and can get more creative. Now, there certainly are oncologists who will partner when I ask for more genetic testing, more individualized decision making, and if we have something that shows that standard of care would not be the best choice and we could make a better choice, then you need an oncologist who will lobby for that with the insurance company for that patient. So that's sort of the dilemma of oncologists in general. I really like to work with top-notch oncologists because quite often they know the newest, most leading-edge treatments and whether or not they're worth considering. Sometimes they'll know of a trial that we could get a patient into if the patient has failed all other therapies. So I like to work with top oncologists who are just team players, who are open. And I don't try to swim upstream talking to an oncologist who's closed and thinks that what we do is, you know, worthless. So the other thing is you really want an oncologist that it specializes. And then we can step in and consider other therapies once we know that we have the cancer under control. I very much am for integrative care. I'm not against chemotherapy or radiotherapy or surgery or immunotherapies or hormonal therapies. My goal is that the patient live a long time. And if we feel that the cancer is one that would be unresponsive to any of those therapies, then we start looking around. But I think it's responsible on our parts to make sure the patient understands what would be a good choice for them and put an integrative plan together. That is my approach, and it really is the dominant approach in naturopathic oncology community as well, is to consider conventional cancer care as part of the plan and help manage it. Also, just want to say that this foundations course is focused on the tumor microenvironment. This is not a course about treating cancer and doing cytotoxic therapies. An advanced course would cover that, but this course is really arming you to analyze and change the tumor microenvironment so that we do the part that the oncologist is not doing in terms of making the physiology less hospitable to proliferation and progression and metastasis. And we can do cytotoxic therapies, but you really need to, that's a whole nother segment of this kind of training. So I look for, you know, a referral that is with a person, a doctor, who's willing to have conversations and individualized care as much as possible. I also partner with physicians who do naturopathic intravenous therapies and other off-label use of medications, prescription medications, if I feel those are valuable for my patient. And so that is because my scope of practice does not allow me to do those. There may be people on the call who actually can do IV therapies with their patients. And then if I don't know who to refer my patient to, I will reach out to internists, gynecologists, oncology nurses, and ask them who they think would be an appropriate referral for my patient. And I do that quite a lot if I don't have a good referral. So sometimes you have to you know, reach out to other colleagues to find the right referral for your patient if you don't know any in your area, because, you know, the docs that practice tend to know the character, logic, and clinical skill set of most of the other docs in the community. There is another question that Todd asked, and that is, what are your specific product recommendations? What are the top 10 foundation supplements? And then he says, for example, I've got a patient with a testicular mass, presumably seminoma, and liver enlargement. He's not submitted to a biopsy yet. I've encouraged him to do so immediately. So I'm thinking I'll recommend that he start with your top 10 supplements. Okay, so what's my response to that? We have to remember that the supplements, part of the supplements are just to support robust health and create this tumor microenvironment. And so I have two sections of the type of supplements that I will put into most treatment plans. But I also refer you to listen to other Grand Round calls where we did have case studies and to look at the treatment plans, and both in the course where there are examples of treatment plans and also in some of our Grand Rounds calls, so you can see the nature of my treatment plans. So I'll have a foundation for basic nutrition, and so I'll put in a copper-free and iron-free multi. I like Designs for Health Twice Daily Multi or Designs for Health Metabolic Synergy, Sorn and Pure Encapsulations and Integrative Therapeutics all make copper-free and iron-free multivitamins. I particularly like Integrative Therapeutics has a line called the Pro Thriver line that was designed by naturopathic oncologist friend and colleague of mine, Dr. Lise Alschuler, and she put together what's called the Pro Thriver Wellness Multi. I quite like that formula also. Then I'll put in omega-3 fatty acids, and I like to use the triglyceride form and have a ratio of about 2-1 EPA to DHA. Unless we have a brain cancer or a patient with cognitive impairment, then I like 1-1 of the DHA and EPA. I like the Designs for Health OmegaVail TG1000, and I also like their new product OmegaTrophic, which has that 1-1 DHA to EPA. Then I'll put in a probiotic, and I like Claire's Therabiotic Complete, Designs for Health Probiotic Supreme, Metagenics makes very high quality probiotics, and I like to switch them out. If a patient is going to be in the hospital, I also have them get BioK, B-I-O-K, which is a refrigerated live culture you can find in most whole foods. I also include vitamin D3, and I dose that by blood level to achieve our goal of 55 to 80. And then I'll always put extra magnesium in, and I'll also, in women, make sure we have bone mineral formula. And you want to remember, most bone mineral formulas have copper in them. So OsteoBen by Designs for Health and OzCap by Thorne are wonderful bone formulas, nutritive bone formulas that don't have copper. And then I'll add some vitamin C as well. So that's kind of what I consider the foundation. On top of that, I'll do a therapeutic shake. Now, all the details and the rationale for everything I just described are in the course. So you can go back and review those lessons where we talk about all these nutrients and botanicals and why we use them. Then the second part would be the targeted nutraceuticals and botanicals that exert epigenetic impact on the tumor microenvironment, the behavior of tumor cells, and the expression of oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes. So I like to put in a curcumin product. I like either Curcumivale or Mariva. Curcumivale is by Designs for Health. Mariva is a Thorn product. Integrative Therapeutics makes a good curcumin as well. I like to put in a sulforaphane of some type. I like Designs for Health Bronco Protect, Thorn, Crucera, or Natura Cell Guardian. I put in Resveratrol, and I like the Designs for Health Resveratrol Supreme, which is a combination of quercetin and resveratrol, or I also like Thorn mix-up product called Polyresveratrol, which I believe has resveratrol, green tea, taro still bean, and curcumin in it. That's a nice kind of cancer formula. And then I like to put EGCG in there. And then I like the EGCG by Designs for Health or the Green Tea Phytosome by Thorn. And then I also put in some kind of medicinal mushroom formula. I like the Clinical Synergy Mushroom Immune Max and the Health Concerns Power Mushrooms. And Natura also makes something called ImmuCare One, which is a nice mushroom formula. And I'll often have some of those that don't have a strong taste go in the shake. So that's kind of the basis. I think that's more than 10, but that's what I think about as being essential to most patients. So this patient, though, Todd goes on to say, had a lactate dehydrogenase level of 304. It was 197 8 months ago, an elevated liver enzymes and a CRP of 8.1. So this is a patient, these are labs of a patient who has active aggressive cancer. Lactic acid dehydrogenase is elevated when tumor cells switch their metabolism from oxidative phosphorylation to glycolysis, lactic acid being the byproduct of increased glycolysis. There is presumably a liver mass in this patient. We're seeing that elevated liver function test. And then a CRP of 8.1 is not uncommon in cancer patients. I just looked at labs of a patient with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. His CRP was 80. So advanced cancers, you'll see these radical numbers that you don't usually see. But this is a pattern of someone with active aggressive cancer. He needs to get to a medical oncologist, be properly staged, and have a plan and treatment in place quickly. I encourage you, Todd, to present this case with as a formal case presentation. We can go over it together in our next call, hopefully. But remember that my system is not based on formulaic protocols. It's a system in which you have to think through each patient, of course, put the foundation in, but then you have to think about each individual patient and build a customized plan and give them customized dietary guidelines and not just copy and paste my treatment plans. The best care is when you can think through and really individualize for the patient. And we would consider the characteristics of the tumor, the genetics of the patient. Is the patient diabetic? Do we need to get a handle on glycemic control? Do they have autoimmune disease, et cetera? So I encourage you to look at this course as a way to engage in a way of thinking and looking at your patients and not just, you know, taking a list of supplements and giving it to every single patient. So that is my answer to that. And just to, you know, red flag, liver enlargement and elevated liver function test, we want to know if that's a metastatic disease in the liver. So there's a lot more assessment this patient needs to get. And if you're the person he has come to for guidance, then your job is to say, go get a medical oncologist. I'll help you find one. And let's get moving here. You have advanced disease. So this might be somebody in denial. There was another comment in Todd's notes saying this guy wanted to do his cancer treatment with just natural supplements. And I will tell you that a cancer like this, we don't have cytotoxic enough therapies to reduce advanced metastatic disease quickly. So my approach is let's figure out how to reduce tumor mass as quickly as possible. And then if we get to microscopic disease and things are under control, then we can primarily use natural therapies. But we have to help patients understand that you can't switch natural therapies for chemotherapy. There's no equivalent in natural medicine. So there certainly are anecdotal stories, but I will tell you, in my practice, the patients who try to do it all 100% natural, who have advanced disease, do not do well. And they usually have their disease advance, and they will often die and die sooner than they might have had they gotten their disease under control with an integrative plan. So sometimes our role is helping patients understand that they should also use the toolbox of conventional oncology. So I'll just stop there. And if anyone wants to ask questions or make a comment, I'll take a breath so you can do that.
Nalini?
Mm-hmm.
It's Judy again. I have a quick question when you were going through everything. You know, you talk often about helping bone health. If somebody comes in, even pre-cancer diagnosis with osteoporosis, and you have them on something like OsteoBen, would you be doing therapeutic dosing, which is much higher than what's recommended? Like, you know, it's 1-to-1 calcium to magnesium, and it's got, I'm looking at the label, it's got 54 milligrams of genistein, or would you go with the recommended dosing?
I'd go with the recommended dosing because you can't make the minerals deposit faster in the bone without drugs. And even the drugs, you just have to have sufficient minerals available to be deposited into the bone. But I do, you know, osteoporosis is a metabolic disease, and bone metastasis is a metabolic disease. So depending on the patient, if their bone, if their skeleton isn't fragile, if we're not near fracture risk, then I want them to do resistance exercise and, you know, have their muscles pull on their bones. And if we have a fragile little 90-year-old, then she's going to go see a physical therapist and figure out how to work with bands. If we have a younger person who's just showing early signs of bone loss, then I'll have her do weight-bearing exercise and not be so sedentary, get a standing desk, make sure she's not eating excess, you know, protein, so that, you know, like a lot of Americans eat way too much animal protein, which leaches calcium from the bones. And I'll often do a urine test to see what it looks like and bone metabolism. So my assistant has just said we're at 10 minutes to go. And so let me get to the rest of the questions here so people don't feel I didn't. And we'll probably go a little bit over. But we can talk more at length about osteoporosis in another call for sure. You had another question, Judy, on resveratrol dosing. So based on a mouse study and also on what would be extrapolated as a human dose. So I discourage all of us to base our treatments on mouse studies. The bad news is that's mostly what we have with natural medicine. We don't have a lot of human studies. But if the extrapolated human dose from this was 1.5 to 2, equivalent doses, 1.5 to 2 grams a day, then you can achieve that with natural supplements. Remember that the higher dose, 3 to 5 grams a day, is a pharmacologic dose. And so if, as a clinician, you don't feel you understand the mechanism of action of any therapy or have not worked at high doses with a patient before, you want to do that under supervision, and you want to understand if a patient has an adverse effect from a very high dose, you need to understand the mechanism of action so you know why they're having that so you can manage it. So just be careful with that, and also be mindful of drug-herb, drug-nutrient interactions. When you use any substance at high doses that approach a pharmacologic dose, then you need to be careful and understand what other medications that they are on. There was also a question about concentration of botanical products and how to understand what's happening with dosing. So the question was about what do we do with a 95% curcuminoid product, and so how to understand that. So I'm going to give you a little quick zoom about standardization of herbal products, and I've also put a link to the American Herb Products Association's white paper called Standardization of Botanical Products. So a curcuminoid is a phytochemical. It's not the whole plant. So there is an artificial manufacturing process that can isolate out a phytochemical and then make a product that's standardized. And so that makes it easier clinically to know the dose that we're giving. But that's not how traditional herbal medicines are made. So there's the whole plant extract, and then there is a plant isolate, a phytochemical that can be measured. And we don't know enough of all the things we should be measuring in plant medicine, but if we have something we know is active like curcumin, then we look to products that are standardized. So if you have one company that had a 95% concentration and another company's product only had a 50% concentration, you'd have to double the dose to get the same activity as the more concentrated product. So that's sort of how you have to think about it. A lot of the products that I recommend use the same, a lot of the companies use the same raw materials, so we're dealing with similar products. But if you're using with products you don't know, then you actually have to look at what the concentration is. A botanical extract might be labeled 2-to-1 or 5-to-1. And what that means, if it's 2-to-1, there was two parts of herb to one part of the final extract. Or if it's a 5-to-1, there were 5 grams of herb that yielded 1 milliliter of extract. And so you can look at different herbal extracts and see if they're more or less concentrated. So that's just kind of a quick kind of overview. If you have a tincture, well, that's more dilute, let's say a tincture says it's a 1 to 10 concentration, that means there was one part of dried weight of herb representing 10 parts of volume in the tincture. So it's a little confusing. And so you can, if you really, really, really want to understand how to look at the concentrations of botanical products, number one, you have to understand if you're looking at a whole plant extract or an isolate. And so that's, you know, a different animal, basically. A whole plant extract's always going to be more dilute than a concentrated isolate type product. And then Cameron Keep had a question about intermittent fasting. So let me go through that and tell you about one of the articles that just came out that I think is useful, and then we'll finish up. And I humor me by staying a little longer if you can. So Cameron asked, you've discussed intermittent fasting in previous lectures. Could you provide a little more information and how it's to be recommended to clients undergoing chemotherapy? So intermittent fasting puts the body into mild ketosis. And remember that tumor cells are more dependent on glucose than are normal cells. Normal cells can survive and function quite fine using ketones as fuel. So if we put the body into mild ketosis by doing a short fast, intermittent fasting, a fast of 13 to 16 hours, for example, then we drop the serum glucose and the tumor cells are thereby stressed. So if you do that before chemo, you go into chemo or radiation for that matter with more vulnerable tumor cells and you get a better effect, better therapeutic effect. And I will refer you back to the course where we talk about the hallmarks of cancer, one of the hallmarks being this change in metabolism of tumor cells from making energy in the mitochondria by oxidative phosphorylation and shifting over to glycolysis. So because tumor cells do that, restricting carbohydrates stresses them. So sometimes a real fast, no calories, is too hard on a patient, especially if they're frail or they're not used to fasting. So you could put them on a modified ketogenic diet for 24 hours, 48 hours before their chemo, where they're not really totally restricting calories, but they're restricting carbohydrates, and just put them into ketosis. A more frail patient or a patient to whom this is new, you might just do that for the 13 hours before their chemo. And so they could fast on a bone broth and consume a ketogenic shake, would be high in protein and fat and very, very low in carbohydrates. And so that's very useful. And so I just tell people between tonight's dinner and tomorrow's breakfast, try to shoot for 13 hours with no calories. Now, low carbohydrate diets not only push you into ketosis and lower your serum glucose and serum insulin, remember insulin is also a growth factor, but low carbohydrate diets will also not only drop plasma insulin, but also plasma lactate. That means the patient will be less acidic. Low carbohydrate diets will also mediate the insulin uptake and glucose, the insulin-mediated glucose uptake by the cells, and then you lower proliferation and cell division. Also, tumor size and tumor growth can be related to plasma insulin levels and plasma lactate levels. So by lowering those by this method, you dramatically lower cell cycling. And low-calorie diets also increase sirtuins and mitochondrial biogenesis and are linked to longevity because of this impact on sirtuins and telomerase. And interestingly enough, low-calorie diets and fasting of any kind also will stimulate certain immune factors and certain neurotrophic factors. And so there's a lot of benefits to these little windows of time of intermittent fasting. And many people just do this as a lifestyle. They just make sure they have 13 plus hours between dinner and breakfast so that they put themselves into this physiologic state. So some patients really just don't want to or can't do that. So shoot for, you know, getting a shake with 20 or 30 grams of protein and no carbs and extra fat in it. And then you could add medium chain triglycerides. You could have them drink bone broth during this period of time or during the first few hours of their infusion. And then the tumor cells are more stressed and we just get a better response to that. So would you like to ask any questions about that? Nope. So I want to refer you also to two articles we have discussed in previous calls, Cancer as a Mitochondrial Metabolic Disease and Press Pulse, a Novel Therapeutic Strategy for Metabolic Management of Cancer. These are Thomas Seyfried's articles, and he is the proponent of ketogenic diets and looking at cancer as a mitochondrial disease and altering mitochondrial function as a way to manage cancer. So that's where intermittent fasting and putting the body in ketosis comes from, a lot of his theories, and he explains this very clearly in these papers. And then I wanted to, before we go tonight, I wanted to just tell you about a paper that was published in 2017 that I've also uploaded to the library, Cancer as an Eco-Molecular Disease and a Neoplastic Consortium. And this is a really wonderful paper that's really about looking at cancer as an ecological physiology, multifactorial, and it's just our idea of the tumor microenvironment. And it also discusses the fact that tumor cells have a lot of heterogeneity, so that going after tumor cells and trying to figure out the tumor cell can be really difficult, especially advanced cancers are more heterogeneous, but it can be quite effective to address this ecological system. And so that's our system of looking at the tumor microenvironment. And this is a great paper that was published in 2017. So I direct you to that. And with that, we will close the call. I'm sorry that I ran over. So we've reached the end of our time for today. Thanks for showing up and for participating. Remember, you can submit your questions and case studies in advance. I like to have the case studies at least 2 weeks in advance so I can really review them and really give you good feedback. We'll be posting this recording, and that will be up on our site in our library for you. And I'll see you next month. And until then, if you need any support or you have requests for future clinical pearls, you can certainly let us know. Thank you, everyone.